Breezewood to Pittsburgh, York to Bradford, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, neither the federal nor state budgets have been approved on time, triggering a partial shutdown of the federal government and financial difficulties for those dependent on state dollars. Veronique DeRugi from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to discuss. Threatened service cuts to train and bus routes in the Philadelphia and Pittsburgh areas have been averted, but mass transit funding continues to be an issue. Eric Montardi and Alex Sardini have an Allegheny Institute report. And members of Congress have proposed the Prevent Government Shutdown Act, and polling shows shutdowns are not popular. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Veronique DeRugi from the Mercatus Center in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Efforts by Pennsylvania House Democrats to pass stricter gun control measures failed by one vote this past week. State Representative Frank Burns, a Democrat from Cambria County, joined with all Republicans to defeat so-called red flag legislation, which would allow a judge to order the temporary confiscation of firearms if they deem a person to be a risk to himself or to others. Burns has held on to his seat in a district that has turned ruby red and strongly supported President Donald Trump. He said he voted against the measure because that is what the residents of his district want. Another bill that was voted down would ban guns that do not have at least one component part made of metal. Another Democrat bucking his party is U.S. Senator John Fetterman, who supported a continuing resolution to keep the federal government operating past the October 1st budget deadline. The bill failed to pass in time, with Fetterman holding firm in his opposition to allowing a government shutdown. Fetterman has taken positions on a number of policy issues out of step with the left-wing leadership of his party. Despite that, he says he has no plans to switch parties and become a Republican. Speaking of budget impasses, Pennsylvania is now in its fourth month without a state budget in place. This is beginning to affect counties and agencies which depend on state funding. State Treasurer Stacy Garrity has stepped in with a $500 million loan program for counties and preschool providers who need funds to bridge the gap until the state budget is finalized. Counties would have to repay the loans beginning 15 days after the budget is passed. Citizens Against Government Waste has named Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro Porker of the Month for September because of his push to increase the state budget by billions of dollars over and above projected revenue. Shapiro wants to raid the state's rainy day fund to cover the spending deficit. His insistence on the spending has triggered a state budget standoff with Senate Republicans, who say the governor's proposed budget is reckless and would result in increased taxes in just a few years. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The Pennsylvania state budget is over 3 months late, and the federal government went into a partial temporary shutdown because Democrats in the U.S. Senate would not approve a continuing funding resolution. Here to discuss the impact of all of this is Veronique DeRugi. She is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Veronique, Speaker Johnson has been talking a lot here as the shutdown commences about the need for federal budgeting in Congress to return to what's known as regular order. We haven't had that in quite a while. So can you explain for us what would a normal budgetary process be in Congress if we were to follow it?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that I'm sure everyone needs a reminder because it's been a long time since we've had this. So the way it works is, like, first, the president, by law, submits a detailed budget to Congress, usually if it's done early February, and it sets his priority and outline for revenue and spending. Now, that doesn't hold a ton of water except politically, because, as we know, Congress ultimately is the one deciding what the budget will look like. So then the second step is like the House and Senate Budget Committee draft budget resolution. And basically they set a framework and they set level of spending and revenue deficit targets and debt. And that's done usually by April 1st, if I remember. Then there are just one other allocation. I won't bore you with this detail. And then basically each subcommittee write a bill to fund specific agency and program. And that leads that entire process of each subcommittee write a bill to fund special agency leads to basically 12 appropriations bill. And then the conference, basically the difference between the House and the budget bills are brought together in conference where they iron out their differences. The final version has to pass both the chamber and the House and go to the president for signature. That's the regular budget. And of course, it needs to be done by the end of the fiscal year. This is not what we have at all. This is the end of the fiscal year, October 1st. And so far, they've only gone ahead with three of the 12 appropriations bill. And very often before the end of the year, they end up scrambling and either doing what we call a continuing resolution to continue funding from one year to another at the level of the previous year because they haven't managed to finish the process, or they do an omnibus bill where they put like this enormous bill with everything in it. Kind of anyway, there are lots of ways to not follow the regular process, but what I laid out is the regular process.
And it seems in recent years we have had these giant so-called omnibus bills, Veronique, that come up around Christmas time, a time when obviously lawmakers are wanting to get out of town and get back to their family. So all the pressure comes on at that point. But in an effort to somewhat avoid that, now, Speaker Johnson is asking for a few additional weeks for the process that you just outlined to take effect. However, this past week, we had a number of votes to make that happen, and it did not as of the 1st of October. So that being the case, there's a government shutdown. Veronique, does the government really shut down?
No, some parts of the government shut down. A lot of people are not paid. The program that usually continues are the mandatory spending that are unaffected by annual appropriation, and that's like a big part of the budget. That's close to 70% of the budget. So that's like Social Security, Medicare, SNAP, food stamps, and a few other programs, the Highways Fund, Trust Fund Project, interest on the debt. That's not affected. But programs that are affected are all the stuff that we call discretionary spending. And so that's things like education, housing program, child nutrition, workforce program, health, like a bunch of other health program like the CDC and some of the IRS and things like this are affected. Even the military. So the military continue the essential programs as part of the discretionary budget that are labeled essential. So that's the military, that's air traffic controllers, for instance, some part of the IRS. These people have to work, but I think they're paid or suspended. They will be paid back when the government reopens. Other people are furloughed.
It is interesting here that President Trump and his various folks who work with him on the budget are saying, well, in terms of these so-called non-essentials, as you've just outlined, Veronique, there are some essential parts of the government that go on. Non-essentials don't. The president is saying this is an opportunity for him to legally be able to not lay off, but actually fire workers and agencies that he's been wanting to trim anyhow. So is this, in fact, an opportunity for the president to further his agenda?
It certainly is. I assume he legally can do it. I mean, obviously, the president has the legal authority to dispose of people in the executive branch. But I don't know if they're going to do it. I know that a memo was sent to the agencies. I don't know if it's also wise to do it this way, to do it the personnel route, because until Congress tells these agencies to not spend money on these programs, the programs are going to continue spending just with fewer people. So I'm not exactly sure of the wisdom of that policy.
We are talking with Veronique DeRugge, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, that at George Mason University. We'll have her tell us a little bit more about the Mercatus Center a little later on. Now we have this partial shutdown that is taking place here. Republicans in the House did pass a continuing resolution, a so-called clean bill. What do they mean by that?
So what they mean by this, it's a continuing resolution is basically a bill that continues in the new fiscal year. So right now we've entered the fiscal year 2026. Continue into the new fiscal year, the spending level of the last fiscal year, 2025. And so basically what this bill was doing is it was extending the 2025 levels without any addition or subtraction to the 2025 level. It was extending these levels of spending all the way, I think, to November 21st to basically give time to Congress to do the other appropriations bill, 8 appropriation bills that they needed to do.
So the snafu then is in the U.S. Senate, where it takes a 2/3 majority to cut off debate and actually move to vote on a bill. Democrats, Veronique, have almost unanimously, I think they lost 2, maybe 3 votes on the preliminary votes on this, have been standing up against this clean bill, which, as you pointed out, was the continuation of the 2025 budget. Hence, it was a budget that was done during the Biden administration, so it would continue, in effect, Biden-era spending levels. The Democrats, however, want to add some other things. What sort of policy issues are they trying to add to this continuing resolution that has created this stalemate?
So actually, you're very right that actually the Democrats, along with the Republicans, have voted for that level of spending, this particular level of spending, twice. One in December 2024, when they did a first continuing resolution, and once in March 2025, when they did another one. And so these are Biden-level spending that they have voted for in the past and that they've agreed to in the past. The reason why this time they refused to do so is because they wanted, if you remember with the One Big Beautiful Bill, this was a tax cut that was in small part paid for with reform to Medicaid, which resulted in a slowdown in the growth of spending of Medicaid. In part, it was doing work requirements for Medicaid, and it was also removing Medicaid for illegal immigrants. It was closing some tax loopholes on the Medicaid side, which was only benefiting providers and states and not beneficiaries. So it was doing a bunch of things. And so they want to reinstate all of this, which basically means taking away part of the spending reform that was meant to pay for the tax cuts. So effectively, they're pushing for having the tax cuts not paid at all. The other thing that they're fighting for is that at the end of the year, a tax break to Obamacare that had been extended during the COVID pandemic was going to expire. We're not in the pandemic. We're not in an emergency. We should go back and return to regular level. And they want to make that level of tax credit permanent. And so all of these, plus they want to restore, I think, the funding for PBS and NPR. And so basically shut down the government because they wanted to spend much more money than we have.
This also, of course, impacts states, Veronique. And here in Pennsylvania, actually, the federal government can hold our beer. We're now 90 days past our budget deadline. Still no end to the Pennsylvania budget stalemate in sight. What impact does the federal failure to pass a budget on time, what impact does that have on revenue that flows into the states?
Some programs are disrupted that benefits the states. For instance, there are some education grants to the state that won't be paid for, like Title I for low-income school and Head Start. So I don't know what the states are going to do from that money if the shutdown goes on, or I don't know, housing program, like versus HUD rental assistance and community development block grants, they're going to face interruption. The child nutrition programs, I think the Women, Infant, and Children Nutrition Program also is a federally funded, state-administered program. And there are a bunch of other programs like this that will affect the state.
We will continue to keep an eye on all of these things. Veronique Darugi of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University has been our guest today. Veronique, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center.
The Mercatus Center is a university research center. We do economic policies. Also, we are very focused on creating talents in the sphere of free market and classical liberal research. And so we're based at George Mason University.
And where can folks find you on the web?
The Mercatus, MERCATUS.org. And you'll find all of our work.
Veronique Darugi, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Although the immediate crisis has been avoided, mass transit funding in Pennsylvania continues to be a major budget issue. Here to unpack the complicated funding formula are Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini with this week's Allegheny Institute Report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Alex Sodini, Research Associate at the Allegheny Institute. Alex, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, Eric. Thank you for having me.
Alex, you recently wrote a brief, which is available at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, that deals with transportation. There is a perennial debate in Pennsylvania over how to fund roads, highways, and mass transit. Alex, can you tell our listeners, how are these transportation needs funded, and how are they connected?
Part of the deliberations over mass transit funding throughout the summer and in 2013 and 2007 has been, broadly speaking, balancing urban lawmakers' priorities for mass transit and rural lawmakers' priorities for roads and bridge funding. We had previously evaluated testimony over a decade ago, which insinuated that urban gas tax money was essentially being diverted and was then paying for the rural roads and bridges. And the evidence for this was that there are far more linear miles of state-owned roads in rural areas compared to urban areas. So in turn, rural lawmakers should allow for taxpayer money to flow back into mass transit in urban areas. The problem with this conclusion is that state road and bridge funding is not just a function of the linear miles of road. Act 68 of 1980 directs PennDOT to distribute money to county maintenance districts based on a formula which gives different weights to pavement quality, bridge maintenance deficiency, lane miles, and then vehicle miles traveled. Gas tax proceeds are also allocated to municipalities by a formula which takes into account roads mileage and population, and then counties also receive money based on average gas tax consumption over a set period. Importantly, the formula for county maintenance districts weighs more heavily on quality or condition of the road, and so the main factor is thus usage of the road, as obviously the more a road is used, more cars and traffic, more wear and tear. Looking at PennDOT statistics, urban miles total about 40% of the state total. However, daily vehicle miles of travel, a measure of usage under PennDOT statistics, was 68% of the state total. So urban miles account for a lot less in terms of total linear miles, but far more in terms of usage. It's also worth noting heavier vehicles like commercial trucks do more damage to roads, which is accounted for by PennDOT, and typically urban roads also see more truck daily vehicle miles of travel than rural roads. All that being said, the idea that urban gas tax money is flowing primarily to rural roads and bridges is not so clear-cut, even before factoring in other funding sources at the federal, state, and local level, which then raises the question over the efficacy of taxpayer money being funneled to mass transit.
Can you recap what the governor proposed for mass transit funding in his budget and what the House and Senate approved this past summer?
Currently, $450 million specifically from motor vehicle sales and use tax dollars and 4.4% of general sales and use tax dollars are transferred into the Public Transportation Trust Fund, which primarily supports mass transit. The governor's proposal would shift another 1.75% of general sales and use tax dollars into the Public Transportation Transportation Trust Fund. A bill implementing this shift, which would generate around $292 million, passed the House in August, which also included additional reporting requirements and metrics as part of PennDOT's performance reviews for PRT and SEPTA, which are normally conducted once every 5 years. And then an additional performance and financial evaluation would be prepared by the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee. The bill also allowed for $325 million in bonds for 3- and 4-digit state roads and bridges, and a percentage of the sales and use tax shift would go towards paying those bonds off. The Senate put forth a bill which instead would take existing money from the Public Transportation Trust Fund, which was largely earmarked for capital projects not yet underway, and revenue from interactive gaming tax collections to provide around $600 million over 2 years for each mass transit operations and 3- and 4-digit state roads. Assuming an agency which serves a population over 600,000 would use this shift, they would be subject to similar annual enhanced performance reviews. Additionally, there was also talk of public-private partnership submissions, biennial fare increases tied to inflation, and then public safety improvements specifically for SEPTA. However, neither of these bills were ultimately embraced by the opposing chamber, and neither passed.
So what was the eventual plan that was put together, and how does that plan affect SEPTA and PRT?
After lawmakers couldn't come to an agreement, both PRT and SEPTA applied to PennDOT for permission to use funds which had been earmarked for their capital projects to instead use them for operations. The governor and PennDOT duly agreed, which would allow SEPTA, which was running a $213 million deficit, and PRT around a $117 million deficit, to balance their operating budgets in combination with local matching dollars and reserves for at least the next 2 years.
What does the plan mean for the fare increases and the service reductions that the transit agencies had put forth?
SEPTA decided to go through with its fare increase anyway, while a court order had required that they undo their service cuts before this capital shift was even allowed. PRT has not gone through with its plan to raise the base fare by a quarter, and so for both agencies, service will be business as usual. Given the ephemeral nature of this solution, rather than the legislature looking for new funding sources, attention must instead be placed on these agencies' costs. State taxpayers already subsidize SEPTA and PRT to a total of over $1 billion combined, and SEPTA also already received a $153 million flex of federal highway funds this past year. The Allegheny Institute recently chronicled how PRT's bus operating expenses per vehicle revenue hour ranked sixth highest in the nation, only behind agencies in much higher cost of living areas like Boston and New York City. Both chambers' legislative proposals included greater measures of financial accountability and performance requirements for these two agencies, which are certainly a step in the right direction, but quite frankly should have been implemented a long time ago, especially as federal pandemic relief funds expired in 2024 and had largely allowed these agencies to maintain elevated levels of service, which did not necessarily align with changing passenger dynamics as a result of the pandemic. As such, more substantial reform is desperately needed, starting with the legislature ending transit workers' right to strike, as it has granted incredible leverage to the unions and contributed to obscene legacy costs over the years. PRT's labor contract is up next year and must reflect the agency's financial situation. Public-private partnerships are also mentioned in each proposal, but outright privatization needs to be more seriously explored, if not mandated. At the very least, PRT already identified a number of low-performing and high-cost-per-rider routes as part of its planned service reductions, and should be making adjustments accordingly. In the meantime, it's clear that transportation funding will remain a thorny issue for the Commonwealth, and it's possible we'll see the legislature revisit ideas to tie mass transportation funding to new revenue from legalizing recreational marijuana and regulating skill games. However, above all, the legislature must focus on greater accountability and far better stewardship of taxpayer resources.
Alex, great stuff. Thank you for sharing that with our listeners. For Alex Sedini, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
The Prevent Government Shutdown Act would put an end to governing by fiscal crisis. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
It's official. As of 12:01 on October 1st, the federal government has shut down. Another fiscal year, another looming threat of a government shutdown. It's become a frustrating yet predictable pattern. Maneuvering, finger-pointing, and last-minute scrambling that leaves federal workers, families, and the economy hanging in the balance. However, this year, Americans are making it clear they've had enough. A new nationwide survey from Americans for Prosperity, conducted in partnership with YouGov, reveals what most of us already know. Shutdowns are unpopular, disruptive, and politically they're toxic. Nearly half of registered voters oppose a government shutdown, while only about a quarter support one. And the deeper you look, the clearer the message becomes. An overwhelming majority, or 61% of voters, say shutdowns are bad for Congress's ability to help the country succeed. In fact, only 16% view a shutdown in a positive manner. That's not just a partisan divide. It's a bipartisan rebuke of dysfunction. Voters across the political spectrum, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, see shutdowns not as leverage, but as legislative dereliction. Here's the good news. Americans aren't just unsatisfied. They are demanding solutions. A staggering 76% of people support legislation that would require Congress to remain in session until the budget is finished, and only 6% of voters would oppose this. That's not just consensus. It's a mandate. That's where Senator James Lankford and Representative Jody Arrington's Prevent Government Shutdowns Act comes into play. This bill, if enacted into law, offers a simple, powerful fix. If Congress fails to pass an annual appropriations bill on time, members must stay in Washington and work continuously until the job is done. That means no recess, no travel, and no distractions. The government continues operating under the previous year's funding levels, avoiding the chaos of a shutdown while forcing lawmakers to stay at the table. It's accountability in action. Shutdowns aren't just bad policy. They're bad politics. A government shutdown alienates voters, particularly seniors, who are sensitive to disruptions in government services. And while both parties lean against shutdowns, Democrats are more consistent in their opposition, creating a potential wedge for bipartisan cooperation. For Republicans, embracing accountability reforms like Lankford and Arrington's bills could be a strategic win, aligning with public sentiment while reclaiming the mantle of responsible governance. The American people do not support using shutdowns as a bargaining tactic. They want a government that works, not one that weaponizes dysfunction. Members of Congress who emphasize constructive governance and accountability stand to align with overwhelming public opinion. The Prevent Government Shutdowns Act is not just a policy fix. It's a political lifeline. It's time to end the drama, restore trust, and get back to work. Congress should pass the Prevent Government Shutdowns Act and prove to the American people that they're in Washington to work on the taxpayers' behalf. You can take action today by heading to AmericansForProsperity.org to hold your member of Congress accountable to the will of the taxpayer. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WROV-FM in Dubois, WISL-AM in Shamokin, along with WMBS-AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.